It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We dive into sleep apnea now, a serious sleep illness affecting about 30 million Americans, according to the American Medical Association. But only about 6 million people are diagnosed with this condition, in which your airway becomes blocked when you sleep. Join in with your questions and your experiences with obstructive sleep apnea, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Stephanie Jones is here, Assistant Director of the Institute for Sleep and Consciousness at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, where she studies sleep apnea in children. Stephanie, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Oh, we're hearing a bit of a feedback loop there. Hopefully we can work on that. And Dr. Timothy Young is here, a neurology and sleep medicine specialist at Mayo Clinic Health System in Eau Claire. Dr. Young, welcome to you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, Dr. Young... Oh, I'm hearing that echo again. Dr. Young, let's start with you. Why does the airway become blocked when some people sleep?
Sure. It's a fundamental question for sleep apnea. I'm glad you started with that. In other words, sleep apnea occurs in the back of the throat. If you have a chance today, look in the mirror and look in the back of the throat. Whatever tissues you see back there are where sleep apnea occurs. It's a combination of tonsil tissue for some people, the tongue base, but for a lot of people, it's the soft palate with the uvula, the part that hangs down in the back blocking the airway.
And so that's made differently on all people, obviously. When does that become an issue?
Sure. It's different in everybody. It's just like our face structures vary within people. And sometimes there's overlap within families. So that's why some families claim that, you know, there's a family history of sleep apnea. For some of us, it starts early. If the airway is narrow, you can have a child that snores. And as I'm sure we'll hear more about, the children can also stop breathing. For adults, it's usually a combination of weight gain for a lot of us. That's the kind of the main driver. But also, as many of our listeners know, as we age, a lot of tissues tend to start to sag, and that includes the tissue in the back of the throat. And that's why the prevalence increases as we age.
Stephanie, how harmful is sleep apnea to a person's health?
That's a great question, and I think in children,
we're again hearing this feedback. Look, we're going to try to get you on the phone, Stephanie. I'm so sorry that we're having these technical issues. Let me reset here for a moment as we talk about sleep apnea with two Wisconsin experts. We have researcher Stephanie Jones at UW Health in Madison, and Dr. Timothy Young is here at Mayo Clinic in Eau Claire. You can join in with your sleep apnea stories, your experiences, and how you deal with your CPAP. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Young, I want to ask you, how harmful then is sleep apnea to a person's health?
Sleep apnea can harm a person in a lot of ways. First and foremost, it has a negative impact on quality of life. The definition of sleep apnea is snoring and stopping breathing 5 times an hour. A lot of people do it, of course, a lot more than that. As a result, the patient wakes up multiple times per night. And in the morning, the patient often complains of not feeling refreshed. During the day, you can feel sleepy, tired, irritable. But we also know it's associated with increased blood pressure and really a higher risk of heart attack and stroke, among other complications, especially as the severity increases.
What would happen if that sleep apnea doesn't get treated or diagnosed? What are the health effects?
You mentioned in the introduction, a lot of sleep apnea is either undiagnosed or underdiagnosed. And so for a lot of these patients, it just accumulates over time. The burden of this sleep deprivation builds up. I should have mentioned this, of course, affects the patient for the ways I just mentioned, but it also becomes a public health problem in the sense that these are sleepy drivers. These are people who are sleepy operating heavy equipment. And there's a fair amount of evidence that a lot of the major disasters in the world have been not maybe not directly, but indirectly a result of insufficient sleep for whatever reason. So this becomes a public health issue as much as a personal health issue.
That rings true for me. My mom had untreated sleep apnea for some time, and she would just fall asleep whenever she sat down, which was certainly one sign, but it was very dangerous with driving, with especially one incident. And that was what really triggered the sleep test, the sleep study. Can you explain what happens in a sleep study?
Certainly. So traditionally, we really just had one option for a sleep study, and that was what we call a polysomnogram. Most people know that as a laboratory study. So in that study, the patient comes into usually some sort of either outpatient or clinic or hospital setting, and there's a technician there. And the sleep tech wires up the patient, makes the patient as comfortable as possible, and then the lights go out. And we hope for as much sleep as possible, but really we only need about 2 or 3 hours in the lab typically to make a diagnosis. We prefer the whole night. The monitors, of course, monitor the brain waves, but also the breathing pattern. And we look for pauses in the breathing. Sleep apnea is defined as a pause typically of at least 10 seconds or more. So these are not short pauses. And after 10 seconds, you know, the oxygen levels start to drop. The carbon dioxide levels tend to increase, and that's what wakes up the patient. As this pattern continues throughout the night, the patient doesn't usually remember these episodes. They're relatively brief, and the goal is to get back to sleep. But as they accumulate, we can make a diagnosis.
Yeah. Well, let's take a call now. Let's take a call now. Let's go to Adam in Green Bay. Adam, what is your experience with sleep apnea?
I was diagnosed in my early 20s. I had a sleep test study done, and I did have a dental appliance first and then moved to AutoPAP, which is like a CPAP. But eventually, the doctor just decided it'd be better if I had a surgery in which they physically widen my upper mouth and lower jaw, extended it. It's called like a double mandibular osteotomy. It was a pretty radical surgery where I had to have my mouth rubber banded shut for about a month, and you know, I had to have liquids and everything. But I'm 40 now, and I have no issues with it, and I know it's not that common of a solution, but it worked fantastically. No sleep apnea issues since, you know, I've had that. Like I said, it was my early 20s. I'm 40 now. And
you have no regrets of having that radical surgery because it fixed the sleep apnea. Dr. Young, Dr. Young, can you explain the road that Adam took with that surgery?
Certainly, I couldn't summarize the major treatment options any better than Adam did, and he kind of cycled through what some of our patients do. So after a diagnosis, and I should have mentioned there's another option now called home sleep apnea testing that's a lot more convenient for the patient. But either way, the concept is to see if the patient snores and stops breathing more than 5 times an hour. Moderately severe is 15 times an hour. Severe is 30 times an hour. And we've had patients stop breathing more than 100 times an hour. So this is an exhausting condition that I'm glad Adam and other people choose to treat. So one of the most straightforward options is something called an oral appliance. That is like a football mouth guard. And it's made typically to fit you really well. And if that happens, you can sort of increase the airway space by pulling that lower jaw forward. What's the problem? The patient ends up with maybe a sore jaw in the morning, and so not everybody is able to continue on that treatment. I also should say it reduces sleep apnea by about 50%. The next option, as he mentioned, is CPAP. CPAP is kind of a general term for air pressure treatment that we use. There's a variety of forms of it, including auto-titrating CPAP that adjusts automatically to the patient. And that's probably what the majority of our patients use. It's a very successful treatment. As long as you can get used to it and wear it for at least 4 hours a night, which we consider the minimum, most people can continue on that indefinitely. But there are a small percentage of people that say, I don't want to continue on CPAP. I want other options. And so there are a few surgical approaches that can be tried. And again, Adam summarized them well. The goal is to create more space in the back of the throat. And then finally, there's a newer treatment that we can probably touch on as we discuss further here called hypoglossal nerve stimulation, more of a pacemaker type device that opens up the posterior airway.
We are exploring the diagnosis and treatment of obstructive sleep apnea with neurology and sleep medicine physician Timothy Young. Having a bit of technical issues here, Stephanie Jones, hopefully we can get her, a pediatric sleep loss researcher with the Wisconsin Institute for Sleep and Consciousness. Join in with your questions about sleep apnea, your experiences, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, says snoring may be more than just an annoying habit. It may be a sign of sleep apnea. People with undiagnosed sleep apnea often make periodic gasping or snorting noises during which their sleep is momentarily interrupted. And these apnea episodes can occur, as we've been talking about, hundreds of times a night. Join in with your questions, experiences, 800-642-1234. We have sleep scientist Stephanie Jones, assistant director of the Wisconsin Institute for Sleep and Consciousness at UW-Madison, on the phone now, and Dr. Timothy Young there as well, sleep medicine specialist at Mayo Clinic Health System in Eau Claire. Stephanie, what are the signs and symptoms of sleep apnea in children? What do you see at the pediatric level?
It's a great question, because the disorder is quite a bit different in kids relative to adults. Diagnosis is more challenging, and treatment presents its own set of challenges. So in kids, clinically, you often see snoring. So a diagnosis often starts with a parent going to a general pediatrician and saying, my child snores during the night. So snoring, sweating during sleep, thrashing around a bit. And the general pediatrician will look in the child's airway for crowding. So in childhood, just age is a significant risk factor for sleep disordered breathing or obstructive sleep apnea. So not so much obesity in young kids as is true in adults, right? Mm. So having large adenoids and tonsils are a significant risk factor in kids. And one of the diagnostic issues in children that we don't have in adults is there's no real clear cutoff for what is obstructive sleep apnea in children. What is clinically significant, in other words? So in adults, we have, you know, this AHI, which Dr. Young probably talked about. Of course, I wasn't on the radio
That's
then.
That's okay. AHI, like kind of a continuum of, explain what AHI is.
So AHI is a number. It's the apnea hypopnea index. That's the number of times a patient stops or pauses breathing in 1 hour. So in adults, there are clear, you know, I mean, arbitrary, but clear cutoffs for this is a disorder. So an AHI of 10 in an adult, we know that's problematic. We know it warrants treatment. In children, far less clear. So anything over 2, an AHI over 2 is generally considered treatable in children.
So would you then take the tonsils out? I mean, is surgery more of an option in children?
So surgery is considered the first line of treatment in children,
okay.
In fact. But there's there isn't a real good correlation between the size of the tonsils and the severity of obstructive sleep apnea in kids. So, you know, it's not clear. The tonsils certainly are not the whole story here. There are other things. So kids also tend to have, often when they're young, they have retrognathia. The jaw sort of slides back. Mm-hmm. This crowds the airway. So there are diagnostic complications. And whether or not a child has the tonsils and adenoids removed is a sort of a judgment call.
We're talking about sleep apnea with two Wisconsin experts, researcher Stephanie Jones there, UW Health, Dr. Timothy Young at Mayo Clinic in Eau Claire. Let's take another call now. Tom in Burlington. Tom, hi.
My brother has sleep apnea. He's connected to a machine, and now he's got some kind of thing where he's got Alzheimer's. And I think it's kind of related to not having enough oxygen through his entire lifetime. But my question is, I wonder if they've ever done studies between this thing of shallow chest breathers, do they get it, and between deep belly breathers, if they get it. But my question is, weight, what is the connection between overweight people and people who are not overweight with this problem?
Tom, thank you for bringing up several interesting things to dig into. Dr. Young, first on obesity, on being overweight, what impact does that have?
Sure. We know increasing weight has a direct correlation with the severity of sleep apnea. In fact, some people go from simply snoring, they gain weight, and that produces sleep apnea. I always like to say snoring is a social problem. It wakes up a bed partner, but it doesn't usually bother the patient, whereas sleep apnea is more of a medical issue, as we talked about. The good news is with substantial weight loss, some people have been able to eliminate sleep apnea without further treatment. So I always encourage my patients in that regard. With respect to Tom's other interesting questions, we're primarily talking about obstructive sleep apnea, and by definition that means snoring and stopping breathing with an obstruction in the back of the airway. There is a second type of sleep apnea called central sleep apnea. In that condition, the airway is basically open, but the brain forgets to breathe. Mm. And there are some medical and other physiologic causes for central sleep apnea, so maybe that's what Tom was alluding to. And then finally, he brings up this really interesting question about whether untreated sleep apnea can lead to Alzheimer's disease. And then, of course, the bigger question of what if we could treat sleep apnea and reverse memory loss. I think we can all agree that if we don't sleep well, we are not as sharp the following day. The bigger question is whether it really causes the pathological change that we see in Alzheimer's and other dementias and whether we can reverse that.
What about the cardiovascular risks, the risk for heart attack or stroke?
Right, right. Those are several fold with untreated sleep apnea. And so we really encourage people to seek out care early before those changes happen to the heart and the brain, because we want to prevent these kinds of problems before they're already developing.
Let's go to Carlene in Madison with a question. Carlene, what comes up for you?
I've had it for, I've been on the machine, CPAP machine for 20 years. Am I going to be on this for the rest of my life? I guess I'm not a candidate for that. Can't remember what it's called that they put in your chest or whatever. That you can turn on, turn off.
An implant type. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm not a candidate for that, but, I've had this for 20 years, and then when I had my sleep study done, I stopped breathing 68 times within that hour.
Okay. So. Stephanie Jones, is this a lifetime condition?
Well, as Dr. Young mentioned, it's often associated with overweight or obese, so weight loss can help, but it is also, at least at the developmental extremes, in childhood, in older age, it's associated with age and aging. I think Dr. Young also mentioned this. So it's probably, yes, she very well may need to use a CPAP machine forever.
what about your neck girth or, male too versus female? What are some of the other associations with sleep apnea?
It's certainly true that male gender increases your risk, but postmenopausally, it's not really clear why this is. But after menopause, women are more likely to develop sleep apnea, even if they're not overweight. And that probably has, I mean, it's a complicated story, right? But it probably has something to do with, you know, estrogen has a protective effect on musculature, and that includes the smooth muscles. So as estrogen drops, the muscles get more, let's say, rigid. So that increases your risk of obstructive sleep apnea.
Stephanie Jones there from the Wisconsin Institute for Sleep and Consciousness, and sleep medicine specialist Dr. Timothy Young with us. You can join in on diagnosing and treating sleep apnea, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We discuss the chronic disease that involves the repeated collapse of the upper airway during sleep. Tens of millions of Americans deal with obstructive sleep apnea. And one study by the American Academy of Sleep Medicine in 2016 estimated the economic cost of undiagnosed sleep apnea at roughly $150 billion in increased healthcare and mental health care costs, lower worker productivity, increased accidents. Join in 800-642-1234. We have Dr. Timothy Young, a neurology and sleep medicine specialist at Mayo Clinic Health System in Eau Claire. Stephanie Jones is here, assistant director of the Institute for Sleep and Consciousness at UW-Madison, where she studies sleep apnea in kids. Let's take another call now. Reggie is with us from Oshkosh. Reggie, hi, go ahead.
Hi, I'm a truck driver, and for those who don't know, every year or two, we need to have a DOT physical in which, you know, they measure our neck and our weight and determine whether we need to have a sleep test for sleep apnea. And the last 6 years, I've had three tests because no one believes that I don't have it based on my weight and the size of my neck. Are there other ways that we could be looking at this? Because it's kind of annoying having to keep doing something when someone won't take your word for it and look at medical records.
Reggie, you've had multiple tests, but the tests confirm that you have sleep apnea, or what do the tests say?
The tests say I do not have sleep apnea. I've had one lab and two at home.
Are you able to continue truck driving?
I can, yeah. I have no sleep apnea. It doesn't have any bearing on me, but some doctors want to give you a one-year medical card instead of a two-year medical card. So instead of waiting 2 years for this physical, you have to go back the very next year. And it's more of a hassle and inconvenience, and I think it's a little discriminatory due to the fact that I am a little larger.
Yes. Stephanie Jones, what do you make of that?
Well, gosh, I'm sorry to hear that. That does sound incredibly frustrating. Do you mind if I ask how old you are?
Sure, I'm 36. I just turned 36 the other day.
And do you know your BMI?
I don't know my BMI, but I'm 5'8", and I'm 300 pounds.
Okay. So, clinically speaking, epidemiologically speaking, you are the perfect candidate for OSA. The fact that you don't have it is, in fact, quite amazing. A couple of things, weight, as you just described, and age, and you're a man. Those are all risk factors. But the tests are incredibly sensitive. So unequivocally, you do not have obstructive sleep apnea. But I think the issue for them is that they believe that you, even though you don't have it now, you very soon will. So I think that's what's driving the you need to go back every single year. But you're right. I mean, I no doubt that does feel discriminatory. But it's not only about your weight. It's also about your age and being a man. And, of course, what you do for a living, it, you know, the safety piece of it. Because untreated sleep apnea, as our host alluded to, is associated with all kinds of medical expense costs, loss of productivity, but also accidents. So OSA not only has an impact on the cardiovascular system, but on the central nervous system. So errors, driving trucks, things like that are high in that population.
Reggie, thank you so much for the call. Dr. Young, I want to turn to CPAP machines because we saw the manufacturer Philips recall millions of sleep apnea machines after discovering the sound dampening foam in the machines can break down over time. What are you hearing from patients about the effects of this recall?
Sure. It's a good point to remind everyone that, in general, CPAP is very safe. They have humidifiers that are also safe to use. But unfortunately, this this brand of CPAP machine has had some problems. So it pertains to the foam that's a sound dampening material within the device. And over time, that foam can break down. And there's two possibilities that can occur. One, the foam can break down into particles, which could go into the patient's lungs or be swallowed. So obviously, if it goes into your mouth, you might either breathe it into your lungs or swallow it. And then the more complicated concept is something called volatile organic compounds, basically gases that come off of the foam. And either one of these possibilities can result in a few symptoms, including irritation to the eyes or nose, headaches. It can exacerbate asthma. The bigger question is whether there's a toxic or cancer-causing effect on organs, including the kidneys and the liver.
Is there some regular maintenance of CPAP machines to check to ensure all of the pieces and parts are working correctly?
Sure. As you might expect, there's a wide variety of let's say hygiene practices that our patients employ. Some people wash their machine every day, which probably is not necessary, and some people do much less of that. There are some commercial products available that basically use ozone as a sanitizing agent. And there's been some questions whether that process, where you just put the whole device in an ozone-type cleaner, exacerbated the problem with the foam breakdown.
Hmm. Stephanie, I was reading UW Health is warning on its site that patients may experience a four-month delay or longer in receiving a new CPAP device. And they pointed to, in part, the recall, in part, supply chain delays, a shortage of semiconductor chips. Are you noticing these delays, or how is it affecting, you know, the treatment of patients?
Well, I don't do clinical care, but mm-hmm. And also CPAP isn't standard treatment in children, but it certainly is impacting clinical practice here significantly. So there isn't only the Philips recall, but ResMed, the other CPAP manufacturer, has had some difficulties as well. So it is quite a problem. And yes, patients are being told that it could be up to 4 months before they can receive a machine.
Talking with Stephanie Jones at UW Health, Dr. Timothy Young is here as well at Mayo Clinic in Eau Claire as we discuss sleep apnea. Let's go to Carolyn now in Oshkosh. Carolyn, what's on your mind?
Hi. I just wanted to ask. My dentist is the one that told me that my tongue is too big for my mouth. And he thinks that's why that I have sleep apnea.
Tongue too big for the mouth. Dr. Young, could you address that?
Sure. Again, that's a genetic possibility. In other words, perhaps that's just a family trait. Believe it or not, as we age and gain weight, some of us gain weight in our tongue, just like we gain it everywhere else. One clue you might get is if you look in the mirror and you can see the lines of your teeth, sort of an outline of ridges along the sides of your tongue, that's a clue that the tongue is pushing against the teeth, and those impressions suggest the tongue is too big.
Carolyn, thank you for the call. Dr. Young, what alternatives are available to patients who prefer to avoid using a CPAP machine? Because, you know, we've seen commercials now of this Inspire implant. What is it?
Yes, the Inspire implant is, as I mentioned, a hypoglossal nerve stimulator. In other words, it's a little pacemaker that goes typically on the right side of the chest wall, the battery implanted under the skin, and then the wires are implanted surgically that they run up to the back of the throat. This stimulates the nerves that control the tongue and some of the other muscles in the back of the throat. And so it's a low-level stimulation while you're asleep that creates more room in the back of the throat. The key is to shut it off during the day. Otherwise, you'll have trouble talking.
How successful is it in controlling sleep apnea?
It was approved by the FDA in 2014. It's been employed in Europe and the United States. As a physician, I try to maintain a healthy skepticism to any new treatment, but I've been persuaded by the results. I've seen patients who have undergone sleep studies with the device in. That's one of the requirements, and they show a significant improvement. The key is these patients have to try and fail CPAP first. In other words, CPAP is our first line and best treatment, and so they have to show that CPAP doesn't work for them, because this is quite a commitment to have this procedure done and have it in implanted for the rest of your life.
With the CPAP, how often does that fail? Because, you know, in order to go to this next stage?
Sure. Our patients are expected to use the machine for at least 4 hours a night. And really, in clinical experience, I found people either use it all night or they don't use it much at all. It's kind of unusual just to use it for a few hours, although I have some patients that do that. We think of 4 hours as kind of the minimum, because you'll get you'll start to get the benefits at that point. The published research shows maybe 50, 60, 70% of people can use it on a nightly basis. Again, my clinical practice, it's at least 70%, and yet we want to offer other options. Just as an aside, there is some research regarding medication. Mm. And again, you think, really, a pill is going to fix sleep apnea? There's a recent study showing that a combination of neurotransmitters that target the muscles in the posterior airway might be safe, well-tolerated, and potentially a good treatment for sleep apnea in the future. This won't be this year. It'll be in the coming year.
Medications for the future. Stephanie, when you look at this array of different treatment paths, what about children here? Because you mentioned surgery, the first line of action.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great question. So children don't now, preteen children don't typically use CPAP. So other than having the adenoids and tonsils removed, kids are also sometimes given anti-inflammatory nasal steroids, for example, to reduce inflammation in the upper airway. That is an effective treatment in kids. Also, rarely oral appliances are used as a treatment. So an oral appliance you get from an orthodontist or a dentist, and it sort of moves your jaw forward, keeps it in place. And for folks with, mild OSA, an oral appliance can sometimes be an effective treatment.
And that oral appliance would then be fit by your dentist? Is that how it would work? Okay. And you would wear that appliance at night to move the jaw forward in order to get more of that airway opening?
Yes, exactly. That's how it works.
All right. Well, Stephanie Jones is with us, a pediatric sleep loss researcher with the Wisconsin Institute for Sleep and Consciousness. And we have Dr. Timothy Young, a neurology and sleep medicine specialist. As we talk about sleep apnea treatment effects, you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Researchers find that ongoing sleep illnesses like obstructive sleep apnea can have a role in other health problems like heart attack and stroke, diabetes, obesity, cancer, and depression. We discuss sleep apnea, the episodes, how to get a restful sleep. Still time to talk. Your questions, 800-642-1234. We have pediatric sleep loss researcher from the Wisconsin Institute for Sleep and Consciousness, Stephanie Jones, is here. And we have Mayo Clinic Health System sleep medicine specialist, Dr. Timothy Young. They stay with us. Let's take another call now. Albert is with us in Wausau. Albert, hi. What's on your mind?
Good morning. My question is have there been any studies or, you know, knowledge amongst your guests of correlation between suicide from lack of sleep or sleep apnea?
Suicidal thoughts and sleep apnea due to a loss of sleep. Dr. Young, can you field that?
Albert asked a good question. We do know that untreated sleep apnea and the associated sleep deprivation can lead to a variety of psychological symptoms, psychological distress. The best correlations have been seen with things like depression and low mood. We talked about the cognitive changes. I'm honestly not sure about any direct correlation with suicide, but it's an excellent question.
Stephanie, what might be the effects on a child's brain with sleep apnea?
From the perspective of suicide or just more generally?
More generally, too, yes.
So that is specifically what I am interested in and what I study is the relationship between OSA and its severity and daytime impairments in kids. So there's always been this sort of suspected relationship between ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and obstructive sleep apnea in kids. And this is because, you know, we don't know why that is, but we do know that sleep loss affects cognitive performance and academic performance. So there are significant next day impacts of not getting a good night's sleep. That's true in adults, but also true in children. And so what I was interested, you know, what my research is focused on is sort of trying to figure out what is that relationship exactly? What is it about OSA that leads to daytime impairments in children? Is it about oxygen desaturation or is it about sleep fragmentation across the night, which is a consequence, obviously, of OSA?
Is there enough research in this area? Because when we think of sleep apnea, we think of the impact on adults.
We do. There is the research in kids is growing, but yes, it's definitely an area where there needs to be more work done. And in kids, it's when you look at a sleep study, so when you look at an EEG, so the recording of the brain during sleep, in adults, when somebody has a high AHI, that apnea hypopnea index, you can just glance at the brain readout and say, oh gosh, this person has really disrupted sleep. In children, it's not so clear. And we used to believe, well, kids don't arouse. Kids aren't waking up all night long like adults are because we know sleep is so important for the brain in children, so important for brain development. But I think we've come to understand that's not true. Kids are arousing and there is sleep fragmentation at all levels of OSA, all levels of severity. But maybe we don't have the tools to explore that the right way.
Let's take another call. Justin with us in Stevens Point. Justin, what would you like to bring up?
I've been using a CPAP for over 10 years and I have to consistently run the machine at very sub-therapeutic pressure because of getting air in my stomach. You know, it's quite distressful, and the only solution my neurologist can come up with have been just to reduce the pressure which is effective, but then I have, you know, more episodes of apnea. And unfortunately, the several physicians I've dealt with, they really don't hear this complaint from patients much, if at all, honestly. And there's just been no solution I can find on my own or from the physicians.
Justin, thank you. Dr. Young.
Justin, that is a good question, and we do see this. It's not common. We even have a term for it. It's called aerophagia, and it comes as a result of the pressured air going in the nose or the mouth, and then, of course, it could either go in your lungs or you could be swallowing it, and it's uncomfortable. Some of the approaches we take are exactly what your doctor has tried, which is to turn down the pressure. The theory is that it would then be going into your lungs and not your stomach. Secondly, there's a variety of masks. You can have a nasal mask or a full face mask going over the nose and mouth. And sometimes one mask works better than another. Occasionally, I've had patients take a night off or two from CPAP, and that improves. And the next time they resume CPAP, things go much better. In the end, this might be a case where a patient just can't tolerate CPAP. And then there are these other treatment options.
Justin, thank you. When is it time, Dr. Young, to see a sleep specialist versus what your primary care physician can do for you in sleep apnea?
Mm-hmm. I would say bring up sleep when your bed partner brings it up. You're asleep. You don't know what's going on. You're unconscious. Most bed partners really want what's best for you, and so really believe them when they say that. I've had more than one bed partner bring in a recording and demonstrate what they have to listen to at night. Really, if you start to notice a lack of focus, difficulty staying awake, especially in the afternoon, reaching for more caffeine than you've ever done before, those are all signs that you're more tired than you want to be. And then the sleep specialist can help decide what test is right for you and then what treatment option.
I also want to address cost, because these sleep studies can be very costly. Kaiser Health News has reported that many insurers refuse to pay for CPAP machines if you are borderline on the apnea definition. What advice do you have for patients to not get overrun with costs in treating sleep apnea?
I'm glad you brought up the question of cost. Fortunately, I said the home sleep studies are more common and they are much cheaper than the laboratory studies. And depending if you qualify for it, most people can end up doing a home study. Once you do have a diagnosis, the treatment is expensive. I sometimes turn that around and say, what's the cost of not treating sleep apnea? And the costs, as we've already mentioned, are astronomical.
Well, Stephanie and Dr. Young, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's been fun.
That was Stephanie Jones, Assistant Director of the Wisconsin Institute for Sleep and Consciousness at UW-Madison. Dr. Timothy Young is a sleep medicine specialist at Mayo Clinic Health System in Eau Claire. And by the way, we have a link to the Philips Respironics voluntary recall information for their CPAPs. That link is at wpr.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.